Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. For scheduling reasons, we're recording this episode on March the 4th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. My co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the University of Maryland in Baltimore, Maryland.
And today we're very, very happy to welcome a guest, Lindsay Wiley, professor of law, director of the Health Law and Justice Program at American University Washington College of Law in Washington, D.C. Professor Wiley is a compelling voice in modern public health law. Welcome, Lindsay.
Thanks. I'm so happy to be here, Nick and Frank.
Good. Well, our format is simple. Our health law topics usually are a bit more challenging. So let's start, Lindsay, by... you correcting my old-fashioned conception of public health law. A few relatively underpowered state health departments dealing with infectious diseases, plus the odd intervention by the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. I've got a feeling your contemporary view is somewhat different.
Well, I think it wouldn't just be my contemporary view, but that of even the general populace. I think public health and public health law are becoming a more noticeable part of our lives on a day-to-day basis. Modern public health law, or what we sometimes call the new public health, expands beyond infectious disease control to also take a close look at the role of public health policy, of public health education and behavior initiatives, and also public health law in addressing non-communicable diseases, reducing the risk of diabetes, of heart disease, and cancers. It also takes a slightly different approach than the old public health law to infectious disease control as well, thinking not just in terms of the use of medical strategies, although vaccination and in public health emergency situations, isolation and quarantine are still a part of public health law, certainly. It also expands beyond those strategies to look at the sort of social influences and environmental factors that affect our infectious disease risks. So even something like hospital-acquired infections, thinking not just in terms of older strategies for, you know, developing a new vaccination or trying to develop new medical countermeasures, thinking also just in terms of how to encourage employees and others to engage in hand hygiene on a routine basis, how to use financial incentives to encourage hospitals to adopt whatever measures they find work best to reduce those hospital-acquired infections. So new public health and new public health law I see as expanding in two different directions. One is moving beyond infectious disease to encompass non-communicable disease as well as injuries. And two, moving beyond the most proximal determinants of any kind of health threat to address more upstream determinants, the social, economic, cultural factors that play a role in determining disease risk as well as injury risk.
That is such a fascinating account of the changes in public health, Lindsay, and I've certainly enjoyed and learned a lot following that in your articles over the past few years. One question I had is, it seems as though with the going along with the more far-reaching, perhaps ambitious models of public health that show up in, say, wellness programs, which portend, say, more social control or more influence over people's lifestyle choices, we see simultaneously a weakening of some aspects of the old public health law. For example, the rise of non-medical exemptions to vaccinations. And I'm wondering if you think those things are at all related, or if these are just two separate currents with an old and a new public health law going on simultaneously.
Yeah, that's a great question, Frank, and something that my colleagues and I have been discussing actively, especially over the last few months with the rise of interest in vaccine exemptions and some other issues that we see as related to that. I think, you know, I'll set aside my objection to your characterization of wellness programs as a public health strategy. We can talk about that a little later. I think that's part of what we'd plan to discuss. But in thinking about whether the backlash against sort of what are described as paternalistic public health measures to encourage healthy eating and physical activity and abstinence from smoking and moderation of consumption of unhealthy foods, those measures like the menu labeling and trans fat bans on restaurant food and the Porsche and control rule in New York City, Happy Meal ordinances in some California local jurisdictions. There's definitely, you know, the backlash against those measures in the popular media, and really coming, you know, somewhat bipartisan backlash. I mean, when you've got Jon Stewart on The Daily Show talking about what a terrible idea something is, it's not only conservatives that you've got to worry about. I think that backlash was to some extent inevitable. When you start talking about the health risks that are really driven by consumer products, some of which have very high profit margins, like sugary drinks, you're on a collision course with some powerful industry players. On the other hand, it's interesting to think about the extent to which the rhetoric that those industry players have very successfully used to promote the idea that these are personal issues, not public issues, that it's a matter of personal choice and personal responsibility to take care of your own health and that of maybe your children. But beyond that, we really don't have much stake in each other's health. Whether that sort of message is also part of what's behind the sort of new challenges to vaccination mandates, and I would add water fluoridation to that list as well. I think there are also different phenomena happening in these two areas, and they're interrelated in some really interesting ways, though. So the other thing that I see happening with water fluoridation and vaccination mandates is kind of what I think of as really bordering on fetishization of naturalness. And I think that's a distinct phenomenon from just the idea that, you know, government should keep its hands off my big gulp. But those two kind of camps are also finding some common ground. So you see, for example, food libertarians who are opposed to the requirement that milk products be pasteurized. They want to be able to buy and sell raw milk. You see those folks who generally are not the same people who are buying, you know, 64-ounce sodas, finding that they have something in common in kind of a food libertarian position with people who are fighting restrictions on sugary drinks. And so I think that's an interesting phenomenon to keep an eye on.
So Katie Pratt had an interesting piece in the Connecticut Journal last year talking about the distinction between sort of older public health interventions and sort of new interventions, which is sort of behavioral interventions, which are more upstream. And she said that public health regulators face an uphill battle to justify these upstream public health interventions, even when they're sort of not using particularly coercive interventions, but maybe even sort of nudges. And if you agree with that, I wonder whether that's a function of the legal system and the standards in play with regard to the validity of these interventions, or whether it's because the evidence isn't very good with regard to some of these interventions?
I think it's got to be a combination of factors, but I think really I see at the root of the sort of the legal issues that favor a downstream focus where causation is very tightly established at the individual level and the lack of an evidence base because there just hasn't been the attention to these issues, particularly with respect to healthy eating initiatives as opposed to, say, tobacco. I think what's really at the heart of all of that for me is the longstanding, you know, what we in public health call the prevention paradox, which really, you know, another way of putting the same thing is just the difference between the ethical response to identified lives as opposed to statistical lives. Jeffrey Rose wrote a widely cited article in Public Health on the prevention paradox, you know, noting that the difficulty that these upstream measures face is always going to be that, you know, you can't point to any given, you know, middle-aged man and say this man is not dying of lung cancer right now because tobacco taxes were high enough when he was 14 that he didn't have enough pocket money to buy cigarettes at the corner store and he never took up smoking. There's no face of many of these measures. At the population level, we know that those measures make a difference. We know that they save lives. But they're statistical lives. There's no, you know, it's not possible to point to an individual woman and say, you know, this woman does not have diabetes right now because at her school, when she was in middle school, they didn't have, you know, they had cut back on advertising of Pepsi and Coke in her hallways at school. They had changed the foods that were available there. Not having a face on those issues really affects our financial commitments. It affects funding for the science. It affects, and it also, I think, pervades our individualistic bias within our legal frameworks as well.
That is such a fascinating point in terms of the statistical lives. And it reminds me actually of a controversy after, I think it was Sandy, someone published an article that said, let's face it, this hurricane is a result of climate change. And there was a lot of controversy over that. People were saying, oh, wait a second, you know, we have to play as honest scientists and always look at these phenomena as being impossible to attribute to, say, one cause or another. And your broader point about public health reminds me of Robert Proctor's work on the field of agnotology, which he attributed, it's the field of creating ignorance, of creating lack of knowledge. And I think that there, he was studying the tobacco industry where, you know, you'd have these ads that said, not a cough in a carload or something like that, and doctors were endorsing it, et cetera. And I guess the question I was having, I had out of that reflection on the history of agnotology and the history of creating incredibly high barriers to action in some areas is, do you think that the anti-tobacco movement stands as a model for future public health interventions? Or do you think that there needs to be very new strategies taken on to, say, respond to industries such as sugar-laden food or other industries that may be adversely affecting public health?
That's a great question, I think, and something that a lot of us in public health and in public law have been taking a close look at. I mean, certainly the tobacco control playbook has been the starting point for thinking about healthy eating. And I think that was a reasonable starting point, but I think it only takes us so far. I think to some extent that playbook is part of what explains the heavy emphasis on sugary drinks, for example. Public health and public health law, we kind of know what to do when there's one product that we're trying to target for decreased consumption. The difficulty, and I'm not saying that sugary drinks aren't a good starting point, but the difficulty is that as industry groups have exploited so well, healthy eating isn't a matter of one choice about whether to take up smoking or not. It's not a matter of a choice about whether you are a smoker or not a smoker. It's a million choices. It's, you know, choices you make every day throughout your day. And it's not just about whether you abstain from one kind of sugary beverage or not. It's not, you know, I think it's dangerous to congratulate ourselves too much if we reduce consumption of one product. It's choices about what our meals look like and what our snacking looks like and what our kind of food consumption looks like over the course of a day, but not even just a day, not even just a week, over the course of, you know, months. I think that's a very different phenomenon to try to think about influencing and to try to think about facilitating healthier choices and a healthier environment in which families and individuals make those choices. For those reasons, I think we're also starting to see some slightly different strategies that don't quite mimic the tobacco control playbook. Although, you know, we're certainly learning from the tobacco control experience on a more fundamental level in terms of issues about the First Amendment and preemption. So the strategies that I'm really interested in, for example, are what I'm calling configuration bans, which is, I don't know, I hesitate to use the word ban, but it's the label that makes the most sense to me. And in that category, I think of the soda portion rule and the Happy Meal ordinance, the nutritional standards for meals that include incentive items targeting children. So the idea that thinking about not just targeting one product, but changing social norms about how we fit together a meal, sort of whether French fries and soda are the right accompaniments for a meal for a small child or whether that should be apples and milk. You know, that's not the same as thinking about whether you smoke or not.
So let me lead you with trepidation into the minefield that's the Affordable Care Act. The basic principle underlying so much of the ACA was non-discrimination on the basis of health, a guaranteed issue, no pre-existing issues, and so on. And Then there's this sort of exception for different types of wellness plans. There are participatory ones and sort of health contingent plans. We now have regulations on that. And yet we also have a sort of, a difficult intersection between the Affordable Care Act, those regulations, the ADA, and even GINA. I wonder if you could help us navigate that a little bit.
Yeah, so I think it's worth mentioning at the outset that the ACA actually includes some really fantastic measures aimed at ensuring population or community health, not just individual health. I don't include the wellness programs among those provisions. There's emphasis on preventative care, there's the prevention fund and enhanced community benefit requirements. But wellness programs are really something else. And the story dates back to HIPAA. We had a 2006 wellness program rule under HIPAA's non-discrimination provisions. And then most of the language from that 2006 rule was then imported wholesale into the text of the ACA as an exception to the community rating requirements there. Wellness programs are something that employers and health insurers are very excited about. I took a look before our conversation today at the most recent version of the Towers-Watson survey of employers, and two-thirds are using not just wellness programs loosely defined, but using financial incentives in their wellness programs for employees. 22% of employers are using financial incentives for outcome-based measures other than for tobacco. So that's not even including smoking status. So that's including things like high blood pressure, body mass index. So it's something they're very excited about. That 22% figure is expected to go as high as 46% in 2015, just based on reported plans, asking employers whether they plan to adopt one of these programs in the next year. I think that interest, what you hear in the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions hearing that was held at the end of January, what you hear in those kind of settings from the various stakeholders in the wellness program world is that, employers are very concerned about employer productivity, they're concerned about healthcare costs, and they want to lower those costs by making their employees healthier. That evidence just isn't there for reduced healthcare costs, particularly with respect to lifestyle changes, weight loss, smoking cessation. The evidence is a little stronger for what I call medical compliance, the idea that we'll tie in a financial incentive to making sure that you take your kids in to get their vaccinations or something more simple like that, or participation in a health risk assessment, but not for changing behavior and not for reducing healthcare costs. So what's really going on? I mean, the evidence is fairly clear. Why are employers continuing to pursue this strategy when the evidence for cost savings really isn't clear when you're looking at healthcare costs across the board? Well, there's a difference between actually reducing your healthcare costs and shifting some of those costs to employees. And I think that's probably more what's at work in this field. So I think, what we're seeing now in the regulatory environment is that the 2013 wellness programs rule really imposed some enhanced protections for employees, imposed some additional regulatory requirements, all of them aimed at ensuring that these programs under the statutory mandate are not a proxy for discrimination based on health status related factors, which the ACA prohibits even in the context of a wellness program. In addition to that, even if an employer is complying with the 2013 rule, compliance with the ACA rule on wellness programs is not necessarily determinative of compliance with any other state or federal law. The ACA says so, the 2013 rule says so, including the ADA. And so you've now got three suits pending brought by EEOC against employers in the U.S. District Court in Minnesota, alleging that incentive-based wellness programs at Honeywell and a couple of other large employers violate the ADA's prohibition as well as GINA's prohibition on on biometric, on medical examinations that are non-voluntary. The programs that the employer, defendant employers in those cases have adopted all involve some kind of biometric screening. And so that's really the key under the ADA and GINA, that it's not just sort of come sit through this 15 minutes a day smoking cessation education seminar. It's have your weight measured, have a blood test done, have various other measurements taken, and that is problematic under the ADA. There's a 2012 11th Circuit case that found that a similar program, a financial penalty for non-participation in a health risk assessment, fell within the ADA's safe harbor for benefit plans. But my understanding, although I should be careful because I'm not a GINA expert, my understanding is that GINA doesn't have that same kind of safe harbor. And so the addition of GINA claims in this new round of cases is significant. So I think the legal environment is definitely becoming less favorable to these programs. In the past, what attorneys advising employers would say is that there was just a lot of legal uncertainty, and that was certainly something to take into account in designing a wellness program. I think that uncertainty is starting to resolve, and it's for the most part resolving in ways that are not friendly to outcome-based, incentive-based wellness programs, which is probably for the best in terms of the evidence that they don't work to make employees healthier and they don't work to save healthcare costs.
That is very good news to hear, Lindsay. I really appreciate that. And I just wanted to contextualize this in some larger workplace trends that I saw in a book called They Can't Do That, Can They? By Richard Maltby. And it turns out that in many cases they can, the they being employers. There's lots of exposés recently about combination of employee monitoring techniques integrated into the Internet of Things such that employers can conceivably track every keystroke, track even eye movements of the employee, track their location constantly, et cetera. And it seems to me that, for many of these programs, there really isn't that much evidence that they're increasing productivity at a rate at which it would be necessary to justify that level of intrusiveness. And I think to come back to the healthcare context, the overall problem with wellness programs, I think, just to give the other side, though, there's a University of Chicago professor, Todd Henderson, who has an article called On the Nanny Corporation. And he discusses this shift from the nanny state to the nanny corporation, where essentially more and more objectives or goals of the state are being pursued or being outsourced to or delegated to private companies. And I'm wondering, his case would be that if a wellness program gets too intrusive, people could leave. But I think that really is troubling because in the end, the employment market is so difficult now. It's so hard for people to find jobs. And I also want to sort of put out there one other source of pushback, which I've talked to some privacy experts about, which is state lawful activity laws. So when Scott's Miracle-Gro was imposing rules that would essentially just fire people if they were smokers, about 23 states, I believe, at the time, they could not impose those rules on their employees because they had state-level laws that said something along the lines of, if you're fired, you have to be fired on the basis of something related to your employment, something that directly affects your ability to be productive as an employee. And I just am wondering whether, in the long run, the states that have these lawful activity statutes, that may be yet another obstacle to implementation of the more intrusive forms of these wellness programs. I know that they're not premising employment on them. They're just premising discounts on insurance. But on the other hand, I mean, these discounts can get very large. I believe the Secretary of Health and Human Services has discretion as of 2018 to increase the discount to 50% or something along those lines. And I think presently they go up to 30%. And I think that when you have that level of economic impact of outside of work activity on the conditions of employment, it is redolent of coercion and coercive practices.
Yeah, absolutely, Frank. I think, to pick up on your point about you know, if employees don't like the program, if it feels too intrusive, they can just leave, you know, to go beyond the specific, you know, legalistic provisions, debates about the meaning of the ADA and any given safe harbor. You know, its purpose is non-discriminatory. Its purpose is to ensure that individuals with disabilities can be productive in the workforce. And, you know, what a lot of these programs sound like to me in terms of the day in, day out experience of employees is a hostile work environment. I think, you know, if you look at some of the wellness industry that has grown up to serve employers and insurance companies who are interested in developing these programs, they really, you know, it starts to sound quite moralistic. You know, the idea that we want to have a culture of employees who portray the right image of health, who are the right kinds of employees. It's an interesting sort of tone that it takes. And if you're talking about someone who has a disability, working in that environment becomes a pretty difficult thing to do day in and day out if we're bringing this kind of moralism about health behaviors into the workplace. I think, you know, in thinking about wellness programs, I've been thinking a lot about sort of what is the appropriate role for corporations, for as employers and as health insurers, as payers for healthcare services, what is their role that they might play in reducing population level risk for some of the non-communicable diseases that are the greatest drivers of death and premature death and disability today. And I think, you know, I've been looking back at the role that the auto insurance industry played when we were first sort of taking on how we could best reduce motor vehicle fatalities. And initially, the auto insurance industry, which, you know, obviously had a lot of money at stake in reducing motor vehicle crashes, for years, the insurance industry adopted the same driver responsibility argument that the automakers were using to shield themselves from regulation, from safety design safety standards. And in the 1950s, you had obviously Ralph Nader and from the public health community, Bill Haddon and Daniel Moynihan working together to convince the auto insurers as those payers that had the biggest financial stake and considerable lobbying power, to convince those insurers along with the public as a whole that design safety standards were crucial. Moynihan used to liken car crashes to typhoid fever, so we come back to old public health. And he'd say, sure, individuals can do things to reduce their risk of being in a car crash, but why is that a reason to forgo other strategies, environmental changes? It's like dealing with a typhoid epidemic by telling each family to boil their water. But why would we rely on that rather than a vaccination program or food safety regulations or purifying everyone's water? And I think that same message applies here. So yes, individuals, individual employees, individual insureds, individual people as members of communities can and should take steps to quit smoking, to eat more fruits and vegetables, you know, to watch their calorie intake and be more physically active. But the science is pretty clear that just telling people to change those behaviors or even using financial incentives to coerce them to do so isn't going to work unless we're also taking steps at the population level, at the community level, to facilitate those changes, making our schools and workplaces and marketplaces more conducive to health. And I think that the trick is really getting whether we can get payers and employers on board with those strategies as well, so that we're not only talking about shifting costs onto individual employees or making unhealthy, less desirable employees from a healthcare cost standpoint feel less welcome in certain workplaces.
So we here at TWIL like to be evidence-based. So let me refer people to a piece by Al Lewis and colleagues on the Health Affairs blog back in November 2014, where they do a literature review. Quote, 4 years into the ACA, we conclude that these wellness programs increase rather than decrease employer spending on healthcare with no net health benefit. The programs also cause overutilization of screening and checkups in generally healthy working age adult populations, put undue stress on employees, and incentivize unhealthy forms of weight loss. On the other hand, to be fair and balanced, there's an interesting piece in Forbes from earlier this month. in which the headline is EEOC's Strange War Against Obamacare and Employer Wellness Plans. Just as we finish today, Lindsay, do you have any thoughts as to how this is going to shake out in the political or legal arena?
I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. You know, the Senate hearings had a definite slant in favor of wellness programs, which was not surprising. And the wellness industry was heavily represented there. An industry has grown up around this undertaking since 2006. And, you know, they have a lot at stake in promoting the idea that wellness programs are something every employer should adopt. Again, I think the regulatory environment right now is really unfavorable to the most punitive forms of wellness programs. What I'm going to be watching closely is whether that interest on the part of employers and payers in reducing costs can bleed over into some of the other efforts that we're undertaking from a public health standpoint that are more evidence-based for reducing the risk of these non-communicable disease concerns.
Well, that's terrific. I think that makes a lot of sense to me, and I think that's a really good response to some very important initiatives from the EEOC.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Lindsay Wiley, our wonderful guest today.
Thank you so much, and this is Frank Pasquale signing off.
You can contact Frank Pasquale at Frank Pasquale at Twitter. I am at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. Thank you all for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.